This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The time is December 14th, 1990, and 15-year-old Charlotte, played by Winona Ryder, is tired of her wacky mom, played by Cher, moving their family to a different town anytime life doesn't go the way she planned. When they move to a small Massachusetts town, Mrs. Flax begin dating shopkeeper Lou, played by Bob Hoskins. Charlotte and her 9-year-old sister Kate, played by Christina Ricci in her big screen debut, hope that they can finally settle down. But when Charlotte's sexual awakening and teenage rebellion gets in the way, this family will be forced to face their individual vices and come to terms on what makes a family a family. This week on Back to the Balcony, we discuss the movie and the Siskel and Ebert review of 1990's Mermaids.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your host Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of The Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
When I added this one to the list, I cruised by it on streaming just randomly, not realizing I haven't seen this movie in years. And I think that when this came out in 1990, I was about 10 years old. And when I went to a rewatch on this one, I kind of realized something, that I was attracted to this movie as a kid from the uncomfortable tones, the confusing topics. There's a lot of hovering subject matter in here that I didn't fully understand. And I think that's what really attracted me to this movie. I know we just recently did Great Balls of Fire, and it realized to me that these two have some similar tone, some uncomfortable topics. And back then, I liked that movie too. So to me, when I go to a rewatch, and especially with Mermaids, this one really came to terms of understanding all these conflicting topics, all these conflicting emotions, even though Great Balls of Fire in the rewatch didn't really have me impressed. But this one actually did. This one actually gave me more depth to these characters and these chaotic characters, and made me appreciate the chemistry between what a good cast can do with some chaotic material. So the rewatch for me on this one actually was a positive one.
Oh, I mean, I agree. I like this movie. I've always liked this movie. I think the big thing, if you're going to compare those two, is that Great Balls of Fire is a cartoon. Like, it's nonsense. And she plays a nonsensical character. He plays a nonsensical character, which is a travesty because they're based on real people. Where this is exactly what you just kind of described. Like, it is a story of coming of age, not just for Winona Ryder's character, but for Cher's character. Everyone comes of age, essentially, in this movie. And even though it does have funny moments and comical moments, and maybe I'm going to even say like some surrealist moments at times, it doesn't feel like a caricature of a movie, which it would be really easy if it did, because it is a period piece. It's set in like the 60s. You've got the 60s music. You've got the Phil Spector wall of sound music in the background. You've got the beehive hairdos and Cher's magnificent appearance. You know, her hair, her clothing, her costumes, her little finger foods. There's a lot of caricature in the movie, but the movie doesn't feel like a caricature. And I don't think it's bad at all as a grown man or as like a young man when I saw this movie for the first time to like it. It is a very female-driven movie. It's a very female-driven plot, but the male characters in it are easily identifiable and empathetic when you're a kid and when you are a grown man, because you find different people to identify with. Now, I watch this movie probably once every couple of years because it's one of my partner's favorites. It's on the shelf. We watch it quite a bit. She loves Cher. I love Cher. But this is, I think, one of Winona Ryder's biggest opportunities of that time of her career to lead the movie, right? She's not just the female interest. She actually is like the protagonist. The movie is told through her point of view, and she does a really, really good job with it. And I think that this movie's been slept on for a very long time. And if people went back and rediscovered it, it could be like a cult classic. It could have a resurgence in popularity because at the end of the day, it's a really good movie.
It is. And who doesn't like Cher, by the way? But when it comes to Winona Ryder, this one, I think, really made her come out of her shell because she can self-identify with this role. It was an honest character. It was one that she was going through at that time. And a lot of other people can identify with what she's going through, with coming out of moving 18 times at the time. That was something that was somewhat common at that point when moving from town to town. For the most part, it was part of almost the American dream of going to a town to find where you're setting. So going from school to school and discovering yourself with even a mother that doesn't really have the most articulate way of talking to their kids in an honest way without sounding like the cool mom. This is where I think a lot of kids can relate, even in relevance to today, where we are trying to really self-discover who we are and how we're vocalizing it. Because if we look at this period piece of the 60s, there are a lot of details here that really does shoot to the setting, but the family isn't the most normal family. I mean, you have a single mom in the 60s that still kind of goes out and meets men, and when it doesn't work out, you pick up and leave. So this is something that moms normally don't do in reality today, is when things don't work out with men, you pick up your family and you leave. So to me, this is a unique situation, and to me, the most grounded ones are the kids. These are the ones that actually speak to kind of reality and the normality of the family environment. And I think it was smart by the writers, these newcomer writers, to really amplify the thought process and move this story along of how this family handles conflict. And I'm going to touch on it in a little bit, but when we get to the climax, that is the biggest crescendo peak to show what defined and how to sum up this story of who really is the adult and who really is driving this family dynamic.
I mean, but we've seen movies like that before where like the parent is in a state of arrested development and it's up to like the eldest sibling or the eldest child to kind of be the mom, be the adult in the room. And that's kind of what this story is. And it, you bring up an interesting point because, you know, in the 60s, this situation with Cher being the single mom that keeps dating guys, breaking up and leaving in pursuit of her own happiness. I mean, we've seen this done again, too. I'd say the most shameless version of it is back in like the early 2000s. Susan Sarandon and Natalie Portman did that movie Anywhere But Here. It's essentially the same movie, just minus the little sister. I mean, beat by beat, it's almost the exact same movie, which bugged me when that came out. And even back then, that was kind of taboo too. And now we're in this world where, yeah, I agree with you where like not every mom does this, but now that we have social media and now that we have, you know, these single mom influencers are like, no, you deserve the happiness to go out and get what you want. And they break up families. I'm not trying to be like on a soapbox and say that, you know, they're in the wrong because you never know anyone's story. But the movie doesn't feel taboo anymore. Like the movie kind of feels like this is what people kind of should or can do without as much shame or guilt or remorse from society or publicly. And that's what brings me to Bob Hoskins' character. I think that's such a mature story to tell where, you know, he's a transplant into this small town, right? So he doesn't necessarily have the small town mentality that these people have of like, oh, this single mom that's run out on her husband or husbands and has multiple kids from different fathers. He's like actually really progressive about the whole thing because, you know, he is kind of a transplant. He's seen women like her before and it doesn't scare him. And I think that's an excellent place to be as the male character of this movie where she can sit down and serve him his little finger foods and tell him about how she had like one night stands with these men and that's how she has these kids and all these crazy like sexual escapades. And in a sense, he's fascinated by it. He's not scared by it because he's a mature man who knows that he's an adult, she's an adult, he's looking for an adult relationship. So it builds that that tension between them as the movie goes on where she's not really an adult. She actually still is a child who doesn't know what she wants. And he's offering her stability for the first time ever. So even though it is Charlotte's movie, which is Winona Ryder's character, it gives us enough drama and suspense, but also investment in these two adult characters that it never feels like a distraction from the main story. It actually feels like it's a complementary piece to it. I've always had that problem with that movie, My Girl, too, is that I always felt that the relationship between Dan Aykroyd and Jamie Lee Curtis is a distraction from what the movie's really about with Veda and her coming of age. I always feel that's like kind of heavy-handedly inserted in there. I don't hate it, but I just feel like it's a little heavy-handedly inserted. Where this one, written, directed, and performed, it feels like it's essential to be able to tell the rest of Charlotte's story. And let's not forget Kate, little Christina Ricci.
Absolutely. And I love the contradiction and the conflict between these two because they are opposites, and it goes into that opposites attract. And we can go into the Bob Hoskins character on intent, right? The intent of why he's attracted to Cher. The movie never really addresses it. We can just assume to it. And it could be the attraction of stability, the superhero syndrome of wanting to take care of this family, or is it a real attraction to Cher? Because we get that example in the movie where he kind of takes ownership, says he can cook a pot roast, he paints a room, and then we have that interesting scene where Cher says, you accomplished this in all one night. And we get into that jealousy argument. So, and that's where we get a real firsthand conflict between these two. And it's an interesting relationship that they have. And when we get into even the climax that we'll probably talk about is the scene that really kind of sums up their relationship. After they have that argument of the jealousy of Cher and Bob Hoskins saying, these are my kids, I will raise them how I want. We have Bob Hoskins on the phone at the hospital towards the end, wondering if he should say something. We know he does, but he can't. He know you want, you can almost speak for him saying it's going to be okay, but he can't do it. And he just hangs up the phone. So it's a mutual respect that we see this relationship between the two grow, and we can kind of almost connect the dots. And it's not heavy-handed because we want to insert the dialogue for these characters on what to say. And I think that is brilliant writing and an impressive feat for especially these newcomer writers.
I mean, they did have some foundation to work off of. It was based off of a novel, but you and I talk about this all the time where sometimes I think it's more challenging to adapt a novel or a previous screenplay or a foreign film than it is to create an original work, because you have to be able to write in someone else's voice, but in your particular rhetoric, right? That can be challenging. I think the movie adaptation is a perfect example of that, where it's like you got a brilliant writer who's hired to adapt a novel or a story that doesn't really have a way to adapt it into something interesting. So it goes off the rails. I think that's a really great insight into the challenge of writers adapting other people's material. Or you've just got the hacks that will just, you know, it's take the basic bare bones and just put the hero's journey through it, and it doesn't even have any recognition of the original works. So having these writers make it this really strong female-led story with three very strong female performances, I think one of the things that I am most impressed by is that we all know Cher is kind of a diva and really likes to own a set and own a scene. Every movie I've ever seen her in, she's the powerhouse. You know, Witches of Eastwick, perfect example. Like, she overpowers the other two, but her character's kind of written that way, so it works. In this film, though, even though she is a powerhouse, that's the way she's supposed to be. And the way that Winona Ryder is able to channel her energy and really add it into her character of, like, she's always obsessed with all these things like religions or mythologies, you know, because she's not a normal girl. She hasn't had time to live a normal life. She's a transplant from town to town to town. She's collecting all of these idiosyncrasies from all these different adventures that she can't even think normally. She has inner monologues, right? And that's the thing that I think really makes this movie work, is that it's not just the Cher show until it has to be. And that's a very, very careful precision direction from Richard Benjamin, you know, directed My Favorite Year. He's a great actor, great comedian. And it just feels right. It feels right the way this film is directed. It had two previous directors. It had Lasse Hallström first, who would have made it very slow, I'm sure, and over dramatic and probably painful. I think in his version, Charlotte was supposed to commit suicide at the end. He left the project. They brought Frank Oz on, who was going to probably make it more whimsical and funny. That didn't work. And so Richard Benjamin found like the perfect middle ground, right? To have enough humor, but enough drama to really make it work. And, you know, my hat's off to him for sure, to make that kind of film, especially as a male director and, you know, primarily known as a comedic director.
Yeah, and he nails it. He makes it work. And especially in his character direction that you already touched on, is it is a controlled performance throughout, because when we do kind of reach the end, that's where it's all in. That's where everything really does have to shine. And I think Cher realizes this, Winona Ryder realizes this, because we get into that religious piece of it where it's her only attachment. This girl will be attached to anybody that shows stability, whether that's God, whether that's the nun she meets in the shoe shop, whether that's the 26-year-old boy. So she's desperately looking for an attachment throughout this movie. And when we get to the one argument between the two at the end, that's where Cher really does kind of own it, because she has to own it. This is where she's stepping up as a mother to really show that all these actions that have happened within this family that she is allowed to happen has kind of just come crashing down to a traumatic event. And I think it was brilliant character direction to really hold these characters back in their own individual worlds to really save it for that big climatic scene at the end that really does attack it as a sucker punch to the gut.
Before we get into that tragedy part of it, because that's, you can't be an 80s, 90s movie without a tragic moment. You can't have it without a My Girl moment, right? We'll get to that in a second. Let's talk about Michael Schefling for a second. You know, Jake from 16 Candles. It's interesting that you brought up the great Balls of Fire connection, because, you know, we have two Winona Ryder roles where we're dealing with a premature sexual awakening. And I feel that is something that was really kind of prevalent in the 80s and 90s in teenage movies. You know, it practically was the whole blueprint for John Hughes films. It was practically the whole blueprint for a lot of the 80s teen comedies, of like this sexual awakening of 15 to 18 year olds who weren't ready for it. And either they were really excited or they were just way terrified and not ready for that kind of experience. It's interesting that you did have Great Balls of Fire, and then you had this, and then like a year or two later, you had Man in the Moon with Reese Witherspoon. Very similar in the sense of like a too immature girl having her sexual awakening a little too young. It's uncomfortable when those moments happen, but at the same time, there is almost like a nostalgic quality to it where it's like, we didn't teach our kids about sex back then. We didn't teach our kids about anything but abstinence. And, you know, essentially with the nuns that were, you know, in the area kind of talking to her, she's fascinated with Catholicism. And so she thinks that everything is like original sin. And if anything, that's what drives her to be a bit more daring. It's an interesting character turn where she goes from someone being afraid of everything to letting her inhibitions go and being kind of sweet talked and in many ways taken advantage of by a much older guy. That's very carefully handled in this movie, unlike Great Balls of Fire, where Great Balls of Fire felt almost exploitive. This one feels, like I said, there's a real heavy hand of empathy towards this character where it's like, she doesn't feel like she's being taken advantage of. Us as the audience might see it that way, like I kind of do, but we get to see the repercussions of it where she's not happy about it. She's sad about it. And she just doesn't feel rewarded like she thinks she would be. And that's a common trope we see in a lot of these movies from the 80s and 90s. And it's just, it's interesting that we're seeing this kind of story told in 1990, because they were really kind of getting away from that as that decade went on, and you barely see it anymore at all, unless it's, you know, I'm not going to say exploited, but like played like in the Euphoria or Challengers, you know, where it's almost artistic eroticism. And this isn't that. It's an interesting thing that when we get to the critics, they don't really talk about that moment. They really don't talk about that scene. But I think it's a very important scene, especially when she's up there by herself after he leaves in the tower. That's where she really gives, I think, her best performance of the realization of what just happened and what the repercussions are. and especially the repercussions of what happens next in the terms of the tragedy and the character conflict with her mom. It's a very, very heavy scene for the very, very heavy subject matter, but not once did I feel that it was exploitive.
No, I don't think it was exploited, but I wouldn't say that it shocks me. And it goes into my cynical side of it, because in the 80s, when we take a lot of these movies with teenage sex, I mean, sex sells, studios found that out. And we saw quite a bit of that in the 80s, especially when we were introduced to the PG-13 rating going into the later 80s. Right. But I think this one is handled well, to your point, much better than Great Balls of Fire. That was just cringy and hard to watch. This one, it really creates points between these two individuals, one teenager, one not so much, but they're both constrained by religion. And this is where they both have rules on what they can and can't do. One is a little bit more mature, obviously, but the other one is a teenager, and feelings of teenagers outpower all. And this is where it does handle it pretty well, where we see the Winona Ryder just come out and just unleash her urges when it comes to all the frustrations, whether that's teenage emotion, whether that's frustrations at home. All of it's coming out in the verge of a sexual nature. And I think it is handled well, because they could have really pushed this and they didn't. And it really goes into self-realize of what's more important, selling the sex or selling the belief, selling the story, and selling these characters. And they did a fantastic job. And we go into that direction again, and the writing here, and it's almost spot on. We're not going too far. It's handled absolutely spot on to really balance that, to prove a point, but not have that 80s motif of the sex sells when it comes to teenagers on screen.
And it also adds to the fabric of the mother-daughter relationship, where like the mother's in a state of arrested development, who's highly sexualized, right? Which has caused her daughter to grow up very, very prudish and censored and shut in. And the whole kind of, I think, point when we get to the end of the movie, after the tragedy happens, is that Winona Ryder's biggest fear is becoming her mother. And with each decision that she makes, as she, you know, ends up having the sexual encounter with Michael Scheffling, and then all the things that she starts doing, the rumors about her in high school, she is eventually going to become her mother. And the point of that is, there's nothing really wrong with that, as long as the mother doesn't try and suppress it and just helps foster her into the best woman that she can. And I think when we get to our critics, some of them have an issue with that, of like, oh, well, this ending just kind of ties it up with a bow. I disagree. I think the ending is very poignant, because what it's done is it's allowed everyone to forgive each other for all the years of just being transplanted from town to town, going from lover to lover, from father figure to father figure, from school to school, and then allowing their own selfish distractions lead to a personal tragedy that almost ends up in the death of a child. And instead of blaming each other, which is their first instinct, they realize that they can use this as an opportunity to make them stronger. And that's the bow. And I feel like our critics didn't really see it that way, or at least one of them did. So before we get into their conversation, what are your thoughts on the often talked about in its reviews of it not really having a stable message or a stable tone, where it doesn't really feel like it's all the way a drama and it's not all the way a comedy, and then it's just a little too light at the end? That was every critic's kind of complaint when I went back and read them. But what do you feel about that?
To me, this is where I think a lot of critics miss the mark on it, because the holistic message here is family, and there is no family that's not chaotic. And what we have here between the dialogue, the characters, the direction, everybody is going in complete opposite directions and complete cinematic chaos in a controlled level, because here is characters that are all going to conflict, to their own decision-making, to it's just, you name it, these characters cover it. And this is what family is all about. And I agree with you, is I think this ending is spot on perfect, because it takes a tragedy to kind of bring this family together. And this is where it really banks the question of, whose fault is it? And this is where the entire family almost has to take responsibility, because was it the daughter trying to hook up in the tower, or was it the mother that led the daughter to do that? There's a lot of moral questions here to really tie together. And it's like the saying always goes, it takes a tragedy to bring people together. And this is what we see in that, is to self-realize that things need to change to really solve this family. Everybody has a level of guilt here. So it's not treated as a bow at the end of the movie, in my opinion, because this is the pure definition of what a family is. So to me, I think this one is a very controlled chaos, and it's done so on purpose.
Agree. And MVP to Bob Hoskins. Like, you and I always love him and stuff. We talked about Mona Lisa being like one of the best movies of 1986. And there isn't a Bob Hoskins role that I don't like. Even towards the end of his life, just recently, I watched that film Unleashed with him and Jet Li, and he's so good in it. And that's such a good movie, and so many people slept on it. It's like, this guy is a major, major talent. And the fact that he does not aesthetically match Cher at all, that's the point, is that he is so mature and confident in himself, in his small body, with his, you know, bulkiness and his baldingness and running a shoe store, but he has confidence in himself, and he has confidence in his own personality. And that is what makes him such a great, great character in this movie, is because he is perfectly comfortable and mature enough to walk away from a bad situation and not chase her when she doesn't want to be chased. He's pissed about it, but she's not used to that. She's used to guys chasing her so much that she has to flee the state. And he's like, I'm just going to hang up the phone. Like, it's such a great moment. And that's like the learning experience for her too. So I'd say at the end of the day, Bob Hoskins is my favorite performance in this movie. And that's a big thing to say, because this movie is full of great performances.
You can take Bob Hoskins in any movie, and I can almost guarantee he's going to be my favorite performance any of the movies, because hands down, he's one of the greatest performers, in my opinion, of my time. And honestly, I would date Bob Hoskins because he's that lovable.
Right. He'll bring bagels in the morning.
Yeah, he is impossible not to love in any movie he's in. He's an incredible talent.
Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with the perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself. Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show. All right, so as they get into this, it is Roger's introduction to the film.
Our next film is named Mermaids, and this is one of the stranger and more offbeat films of the year, starring Cher in a story set in 1963 about a woman named Mrs. Flax, who has had bad luck with men, starting with Mr. Flax, if in fact there ever was a Mr. Flax, and it moves to another town, taking her two daughters with her whenever another relationship busts up. At the last count by her teenage daughter, that has been at least 18 times. The daughter is played by Winona Ryder. This is her third alienated teenager role in about a month. And unlike her mother, she's completely ignorant about sex.
Introducing the film, saying that it's an offbeat film was really interesting to me. I don't feel like it's an offbeat film. And 1990, that was a year of offbeat films. You know, so this is right at the same time that Edward Scissorhands was in theaters. So she literally had like three movies all in the same year where she plays an alienated teenager. More mature in the other ones, younger in this one. But I don't know why he calls it offbeat. I feel like it's pretty even keel, in my opinion.
I would kind of agree to Roger to an extent, because part of kind of what I said in the beginning is there is an unsettling tone. There is some unbalance to it. There's just a big question mark on where this movie is going, because it doesn't feel structured. It feels like it's kind of all over the place when it comes to what's happening. It doesn't follow a typical storyline that we would normally see in a movie like this. So to me, it is a little bit bizarre to an extent. And I kind of go into the tone of that, where it just really feels like it's hard to explain on what this movie is trying to do, on where it's going to go. So to me, I can kind of see it, but at the same time, I can see where it is trying to accomplish something by the end of the movie that you know it's going to accomplish. But to me, I think it is a little oddball when it comes to the structure of this kind of movie at that time.
I just think it's an interesting conversation, especially for like a period piece, you know, because, for example, American Graffiti basically takes place around the same time. I would call that offbeat because there is no story structure to that. It's a meandering film. I've talked about those before, like Richard Linklater movies are meandering. This does have more of like a solid story. I think maybe the offbeatness to me, if I had to define it, is the fact that they are in a very conservative town and they are not very conservative people. I mean, Cher's Jewish as all hell, and you know, but she's also kind of like a secular Jew. She doesn't really have a belief. She lives her life out of magazine photos. So yeah, that character is quirky, but I mean, it just seems like, I mean, when you talk about Edward Scissorhands and Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael, the other two Winona Ryder movies of the year, those are much more offbeat to me than this one. Maybe I'm just looking into the definition of the word offbeat a little too strongly, because even watching this just the other day, I'm like, I don't feel it offbeat. It just feels like a movie about a quirky family in a conservative town and, you know, the things that happen to them every day.
I think the one thing, if we were to look deep into the offbeat comment, if we take a look at a lot of these movies from the 60s that portray a family, and we look at the conservative visual of a family in the 60s, this one isn't traditional. Like you said, it does have kind of a uniqueness to it that can throw off the vibe of what studios might be wanting to look for. So I think it's going to be Roger's definition of offbeat 100%.
I mean, he is the guy that gave us Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, but I digress.
The mermaids persist in treating them as colorful and lovable types is sort of perverse, but it's sort of entertaining too. What's intriguing is the way the performances, especially by Cher and Winona Ryder, stubbornly insist on the perversities of their peculiar characters, even while the movie seems to be going for a happy ending. Mermaids is not a very likable film, but I liked it.
That's such an interesting comment again. It's like not a likable film, but he liked it. I'm glad that he liked it. It's the mindset, but also, like I said, this wasn't a film written for guys in their 30s and 40s like we are, right? This is a film that was kind of written for families and more than likely female audiences. But they gave you two characters to identify with, Bob Hoskins and Michael Schefling. I think that the quirkiness of the characters is what brings you into the story and keeps you in the story. Because if these were blander characters, if the mom wasn't interesting, if the teenager was depressed and dull and not having all these weird quirks about fascinations with religions and mythologies and illnesses and things like that, then you wouldn't be as invested through the movie with the story. Like, you have to have quirky characters. We've seen lots of movies like this. Like, Wes Anderson has built a career off of it, essentially. So I get it. Maybe that's the offbeatness he's talking about. But I just don't understand why he says it's not a likable movie. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, to me, the unlikable is we're not sure if we're supposed to like this movie. We're not sure if we're supposed to like these characters, because we have that question mark of what characters we like up until Bob Hoskins comes on screen. So the Cher, she's not, first rewatch, I'm not sure if I was invested in this. Winona Ryder, she's so dry, so stiff. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to like that character. So it does have this underlying tone of unlikability, because, again, it doesn't paint that picture of the pitch-perfect family that we see time and time again. So it's almost like we're drawn to see this movie that really goes for the dramedy piece of it that's supposed to make us feel good. And there's no elements in this movie until you get that incredible music thrown in where it wants to give you that spark of life where you're supposed to feel good. But the characters aren't really there to make you feel good, but to realize that it's a family and we're looking into this family that has a ton of conflict and a ton of chaos. So I don't know if you're supposed to like it, because that's part of the magic to me of this movie is it doesn't make me feel good. It makes me very intrigued and interested on being a looking glass into this family.
But I think that there's a trifecta of the three personalities that really make it work for me. If you're not supposed to like them, like you said, you are fascinated by them, where, you know, Cher is the bombastic, straight out of a magazine, bouffant and all that, where Winona Ryder is the more dry, drab, cynical, and then you have the precocious youngster. So there's a person for everybody in this trifecta of who you're going to identify with. You know, and it's funny, I'm sure that people have watched this movie through the ages as they've grown up with it. They probably go through different stages of who they identify with as they see this movie the older they get. Now, identifying with Cher doesn't necessarily mean it's like, okay, well, this is a healthy person to appreciate and identify with. No, she's kind of a mess. She's very much a mess. But I think that mess represents the mess that's in all of us. And some people are just better at suppressing it. And then there's people that embrace the mess and turn it into their whole personality. And I think that's what her character represents. So again, I think this movie is definitely like a litmus test to your life, your experience, and your personality style. Because let's say if you're a person that doesn't like being in a room with a chatty group of people, then you will not like this movie, because that's what Cher is. Like, Cher is the person that goes into the room and just chats everyone up as if she's known them for years, and it's off-putting to some people. But you also might be fascinated by that kind of personality because you're not that way. You know, you're like, oh, wow, I wish I had the confidence just to go out and do that. That's, I think, where the brilliance in the writing and the directing is like, it becomes a litmus test for the audience. And that's what grabs you, man. Like, we talk about it all the time. You can just play a movie from start to finish, and if you're not doing anything to challenge us as the audience, if you're just telling us the same damn story over and over again with just different paintbrushes and different actors, we don't care. But you give us characters like this and performances like this that make us wonder why it makes us feel uncomfortable or why we are excited by it. That's when you're reeling the audience in. And I think that's an art that people have lost when it comes to especially studio films.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, a movie that can tell you kind of this is who you are, this is who you want to be, and whether you like that or not is going to depend on the person. And that really does show the expert writing on how to define and how to really emotionally affect somebody that's actually watching. And then you have those that won't be affected at all, that are more sociopaths.
Right.
But at some point, you're going to connect with with one of these characters, as you said. But whether that's going to be a good feeling or a bad feeling, I think good old Roger might have had a couple of off-putting settings on some of these characters. So, because he is almost an introverted guy when it comes to the way he defines who he is. So he's a very private guy to an extent. So to me, I think this one really did strike almost a chord with him on, I know I shouldn't like some of these things, but overall, the movie has some great elements to it to really have some likability. It all comes together. And I think that's what he is expressing in kind of that summary of the comment.
Well, he's always been better. And we've said this now for 28 or 29 episodes now. He's always better at taking the lead that the filmmaker is giving him, right? Like, the filmmaker says, this is what I'm challenging you with this movie. These are the characters I'm giving you, and they are supposed to be challenging. You're supposed to work for your entertainment, and you're supposed to be drawn into this story and this experience and not just sit and watch a movie. And Gene always has had a problem with that, and he says it right here.
I didn't, Roger, and I think it's just what you said, that it portrays these people as colorful and lovable. Everybody has the snappy repartee. I know that obviously parents and children have problems, but why not play this for real? We have really fine actors working here, mm-hmm. but I just thought that everything was wrapped up in a sweet Hollywood script-writing bow, If they just had a natural moment, if they just relaxed one time, if she didn't make the breakfast entrees and all these cute little fun foods, I mean, if can't they just have a natural moment?
Well, I don't even object to the fun foods. I think that's kind of a character detail.
It keeps coming on and over. It played four or five times.
I think what we have here is Hollywood's inexorable push to toward imposing a happy ending on material where it's totally inappropriate. Now, what I liked about the movie is that the characters, Mrs. Flax and her daughter, played by Winona Ryder in particular, go their own way. They make their own movie, which has truth in it, even while Richard Benjamin, the director, and presumably the screenwriters, are going a different direction in order to give us this kind of sitcom-y resolution that doesn't have anything to do with who these people are.
Winona Ryder is a really fine talent. Mm-hmm. She's in Edward Scissorhands right now. She even was the best thing in Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael, a pretty bad film. But boy, she's really saddled, I think, with a really cutesy pie script the same for Cher.
So, you know, Roger liked the movie, but I disagree with his like closing statement that Gene essentially agreed with, and that is that this feels like they have a Hollywood-infused mission to put a bow and a happy ending on a movie that shouldn't be happy. Like they almost like they wanted it to end in tragedy. And I disagree with that. I think that yours and my example that we said earlier on in the episode, where the tragedy has to happen for them to finally come together. And here's the thing. We don't know they're going to be happy forever. We just get to see a moment of happiness between the three of them, right? I think the perfect example of that is you never see them sit down for an actual meal in the movie. Their entire life, they're being made these little hors d'oeuvres and appetizer and finger foods that the mom gets out of magazines because there's no love or sincerity behind it. It's all self-serving. So when you see an actual real meal and them preparing it and them sitting down and them having the family experience, that's the ending, is the family experience that they haven't had for all the years they've been together. That's not a happy Hollywood ending with a bow on it. That to me is just the way this family is moving forward from this chaotic life they've been living. We don't know the future. There's probably a lot of shit they're going to talk about in the next several years about, hey, remember how you almost killed your sister? Remember when you lost your virginity in the bell tower to that weird gardener dude? Like, the trauma's still there. We just get to see the moment of, we deserve this family moment that we haven't had in our lives.
Well, and it's not like Cher at the end is making a pot roast, setting candles right up for a family dinner. It's still the junk food, family finger foods that she's setting out at the end. So it's not like a huge drastic change. They're just,
it's a start.
They're moving on. It's a start. And what really bugged me about this was when he makes the comment, if they just had one normal conversation. And when that comment is landed, I'm thinking back and I watched this review before I rewatched it, and I'm watching this movie full of natural conversation. There's a scene that we have toward when they first move, that they first enter the shoe store, where Winona Ryder has her boots on and Bob Hoskins questioning, and Cher just brushes Bob Hoskins off as just leave it alone. Right. That is normality. These are some simplistic normality pieces that a mom or a father or a parental figure will do, is just, it's a teenager, just leave it alone. There's a lot of normality to this, and it kind of frightens me to a piece of it that the vision between normality and what's on screen is very confused here on this review, because again, we shouldn't have this picture perfect family, and we don't, have this picture perfect climax at the end. Why does everything have to end in tragedy? Because there's some dramatic elements in it. And to me, I don't think it's really cartoonish. I don't think it's really comedic. I think it's a really good balance of how the family really grows to this point in the end. And like you said, we're not going to see their entire life. This is just a seed, and this is just the plant of what this family is going to do next. It's a closing climax to just sum up this family on where they've been and where they are at that moment. So to me, it kind of drives me a little bit nuts with that kind of comment. And to me, Roger loses a little bit of more points for it that he doesn't go deeper into this review.
So this is the thing that I wanted to ask you, because like I said, I do not consider myself a critic at all, because I just appreciate way too much about the challenging aspects of film and the, you know, well-performed and well-delivered aspects of cinema. Sometimes I feel like, depending on when they came back from vacation or what the year was like or what their season they were in, I feel like they create like this base level of cinematic expectation where if they're asking for more natural or normal performances, well, then maybe they saw some more natural, normal movies that didn't have quirks, that didn't have interesting characters. And then they start kind of basing their criticism off of where that is on that medium level. Because there are other years or other decades that we watch these reviews where they're watching pretty much nothing but art house cinema, or, you know, when Miramax came out, forget about it. We have all these new varieties of filmmakers and styles and genres, and they have to adapt to that. So when I think about 1990, like we're a year or two away from like major blockbusters, right? Where everything's changed, CGI and big action movies and big war epics and westerns, things like that, where we're still kind of in this transitionary stage of going out of the 80s into the 90s and not knowing where we're at cinematically. And I feel that is kind of what creates this opinion they have, is they just are in this weird pattern of movies that are being released and of films that are coming out from directors that don't know what the next decade's bringing, but they know they want to get away from what the previous decade had. And so I think that's what kind of creates this discontent between the two of them of why this movie makes so many of us feel good about it, but why they have the same opinion, but on two different playing fields, where Roger likes the fact that it's an unlikable movie, but he likes it. He likes what it's doing. And then Gene doesn't. They're saying the same thing, just on two different ends of the spectrum.
Let's look at when the movie came out. It's December. We have all these feel-good movies, these holiday movies, to the point where this confuses on what they really want. And even fast forward, I think it was 8-9 years later when, I'm going to use a horrible example, Stepmom came out during the same holiday season. This review almost mimics that one, where it comes to a formula. They gave a little bit more positive, I think Gene did, when it comes to the Stepmom review. But that one was cookie cutter structure, try and make you cry, make you feel good, make you cry. This one isn't structured. So he, when it comes to this kind of genre, the comedy drama, he doesn't know what he wants, because more often than not, if you're a dramedy or a comedy, you're really not going to be on a winning playing field with Gene Siskel, because you have to have that in depth. You have to have you have to catch him in the right mood at this time. And if it's especially being released in December, you're not going to get a good review. And I'm sad to say, even at times from Roger Ebert, because there's so many movies that come out full of fluff. There's so many movies that come out during this time full of feel good moments that you have to measure that. It seems like when you're doing movie over movie review to those, that's your baseline. Was it better than the family make you cry movie from last week compared to now? That's your baseline. And again, we've talked about this before, where that's kind of where you're on an unfair playing field when it comes to movies, is you have to have that comparison. And it's to this movie coming out in December, it's an unfair element. And we talk about Roger's point of he doesn't like it, but he does like it. And that's where you kind of get that weird moment, because the release date is in Christmas, and this isn't one of your feel-good Christmas movies.
Well, I think that Roger loses credibility in this particular conversation, because instead of standing by the fact that he liked this movie and defending his opinion, he somewhat tries to justify what Gene is saying about, like, well, this is just Hollywood trying to do this and trying to wrap it up in a pretty bow and infuse their formulaic structures into this movie, so it doesn't feel as... It's almost as if he wanted this to be like some kind of French art house film or Swedish film that has more of a tragic ending. And it's funny, because we have a film coming up in a few weeks that was a French film first that got remade by America, and it totally doesn't work. I feel this is the opposite. I feel like he loses points because he justifies Gene's opinion and not standing up for his as much. And so when they kind of agree at the end but disagree, it just feels like an incomplete review. I almost feel like I know less about the movie coming out of this conversation than if I hadn't watched it at all and just saw the movie going in raw.
It's a really vague review between both of them. There's no real reason why. And I've told you before, that's what drives me nuts about reviews. There's no why to it. Why should I spend this money? Why should I invest my time? And they go back and forth on just vague arguments. And Roger doesn't really have a strong argument because he's even unsure of why he liked it, except for the performances. He gave kudos to the performances. And it's okay to say, see this movie for the performances, but it never lands in this review. And that's why this one is probably the most vague Roger Ebert review that we've seen from that year of 1990, because there should be a justifiable reason, because this has a strong cast. This has a very unique story to it based on the subject matter. So there should be some things to take out of it. If anything, it's the uniqueness of it all. Now, whether this came out at the end of the year for the intent of being a quick Oscar nomination, which would have been a little stretch out of overconfidence, who knows? Or this was just one of those family fluff comedies. So the intent of maybe the frustration of where Roger was and where Gene was they didn't know where they wanted this movie to land, whether it's Oscar or fluff. So to me, it lands perfectly in the middle, where it's going to separate audiences to give something a little different from the art house and from the holiday fluff, to give something of normality to the average filmgoer, to see something a little bit different and something engaging with Cher and Winona Ryder that was a hot ticket at that time.
And I think at the end of the day, maybe this film is obscure to the later generations. You know, maybe millennials and Gen Z don't know about this film that much, but early millennials and Gen Xers, they love this movie. It has a cult following. I don't even want to call it a cult following. It just has a following of the people of that time. When you were old enough to either see it in the theater or rent it at Blockbuster or maybe have it pop up on cable, it stuck with you. It was just one of those movies that stuck with you. I think the tragedy that happens in the movie has a big part of that. Like, oh my God, that scene's coming up. I've seen this movie dozens of times, and every time I'm like, oh, that scene's coming up. Just that emotional response in a film, especially when you see this at the right age, is enough for it to make an imprint in you. And I really don't know anybody that's my age or around my age that doesn't like this movie. Maybe it doesn't have my girl clout, but it's not far off. It definitely has a very strong following. And hopefully people watch this episode and go and visit it, because you'll see why.
As it should have a following. I mean, it's a great watch. It's a great kind of rewatchability to it is amazing. And that tragedy at the end is gut-wrenching every single time. You know it's coming, and you just kind of clench your fists hoping it doesn't. But I will say that young Reese can hold her liquor pretty well when she's taking those back. But kudos to her for that. But to me, I think this one, if you haven't seen it, you need to watch it, because it is unique enough, it is real enough, and no matter what our critics say, it is real enough when it comes to the dialogue and the performances from an absolutely fantastic cast.
Right. So for me, my critic, Mr. Gene Siskel, gets a solid D on this one. Again, like, this isn't a matter of him not getting on the fun bus, like I've used that analogy on several episodes in the past. This is him, again, we've talked about this before, wanting something out of a movie that the movie isn't prepared to give him. He sees it's a coming-of-age story set in the 60s with Cher, Winona Ryder. Okay, I know what I want in this movie. And when it doesn't deliver what he wants, he refuses to accept what it is. And I just don't think that is a good stance for a critic to be giving a critique, a review, or an analysis of a film when you go in with that kind of bias. So he gets a D from me.
And that's fair. Ebert, even though I think this one I'm going to be a little harsher on him because of the main elements of he vocalizes points, but he never says why. It's just the most vague review, and he doesn't really defend it because he can't, because he doesn't know why. The only kind of credit I will give him is he does shout out one of the strongest points of the movie, which are the performances. So for me, if you can't review a movie and say why, that's not going to be appeasing to those watching to want to buy a ticket, and I'm going to give him 1.5 stars.
Yeah, when you have 2.5 minutes of discourse and you can't come to a conclusion on why you should or shouldn't see this movie other than, I just didn't like it, or I liked it and I can't tell you why. It doesn't do it. It doesn't deliver in what you were paid to deliver to your audience. All right. Well, I love this conversation. I loved rewatching this movie. And moving on to next week's episode, we are doing an audience request. Josh Scar of Talking Smack requested that Justin and I revisit the film and the critique of Steven Spielberg's Hook. That's going to be a very interesting conversation, I assure you. So we will see what happens then. In the meantime, I'll post stuff on Twitter and on Instagram of what our listeners and our audience thinks about that movie. If they have any thoughts, if it's changed, maybe it was a ride or die film for you when you were younger and now you're like, we want to know about it, because this really is kind of like an important film for us and our generation. We saw it in the theater. It's Robin Williams. You can't speak ill of Robin Williams, but we'll find out what our audience says and what our critics say next week.
Some of the most memorable episodes of Siskel and Ebert, this one falls into, and I can't wait for this discussion.
Whoo, absolutely. So as always, please jump on your favorite pod platform, give us a like, a subscribe, review us, share us, follow us on YouTube. You can send your listener requests to us on Instagram, either at me, Antonio at The Cultworthy, or over to Justin at
The Movie Wire Show.
You can also visit the website at thecultworthy.com under the Back to the Balcony page to see all the episodes on YouTube and any listener feedback. We want your feedback. And once again, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.